So yesterday, Gil spoke about sensual desire, the hindrance of sensual desire, and the faculty of confidence or faith. And I'm sure most of us, many of us, have had a chance to actually practice with those, with both of those, whether you were mindful of it or not. Today I'm going to focus on the faculty of energy, which Gil mentioned a little bit, or strength is another way of thinking of it, and how that plays in with the hindrance of how we can work with that, use that to support meeting the hindrance of ill will or aversion. So as we sit here, there are thousands and thousands of things that we could be paying attention to within our bodies, within our environment, within every single person here, and not even getting started with our thoughts. There are thousands and thousands of things that we could pay attention to. And including our memories, our fantasies, and different situations, you know, if we're cooking in the kitchen, or attention's directed to something. And so, excuse me a second. Okay. Different situations, you know, what the things we do require us to direct our attention certain ways. And I'm just trying to figure out if I have my mask isn't doing the right thing for some reason. Okay. The challenges of the hindrance of masks. Okay. So our attention is directed a certain way, but when we don't have some, you know, if we're doing something or direction, our attention is directed towards what we're doing. But when we don't have anything that we have to do, our minds tend to go into the habitual ways they're used to going to. And it's one of the things that really shows up in meditation, because even though we might be paying attention to the breath, when we kind of lose track of the breath, our minds go into the habitual ways of being. And if our habits of mind include being very critical of ourselves, that's what happens. Our minds just go into being critical and looking for what's wrong with us, what's lacking in us, in our lives, what we've done wrong. So maybe we're, I don't know if any of you sit in the morning. I used to love when I sat retreat here to sit in the community room and kind of just watch people coming and going, you know. And you know, so what do we do with our minds when we see people coming and going? Is the habit of mind to, wow, you know, how wonderful, all these people are practicing with me, appreciating them. Or maybe the habit of mind is, oh, look how well they're practicing compared to me, you know. And, you know, whatever our habits of mind are, and they just kind of get reinforced this way. And many of us have experienced breaking a habit, right? Most of you have broken some habit. When I was early teens, I had this condition called, they actually have a name now, trichotillomania. Anybody know what trichotillomania is? Yeah. And it's when you pick your split ends, hour after hour after hour. That's what my favorite habit in school was, picking at my split ends. And it was really compulsive, you know, for a number of years. You know, it took a lot of effort to break that habit. And all of us, I think, have experienced developing a new habit. As children, we learn to brush our teeth every day. Most of us don't have to force ourselves to brush our teeth at least once a day. So we've developed a habit. Now, when we were little, we had the advantage of having our mother nag us, right? So it made it easier to develop a habit. You know, as an adult, I've developed new habits, but it was a lot harder. I only had myself to nag me. But so this practice is really about something we know how to do already. Create new habits and break old habits. Habits that no longer serve us. One of the ways we refer to that is, I'm so futzing with my mask so much that something keeps slipping on me, okay? Another way of referring to it, you know, we talk about the conditioning. That's what conditioning is. It's a habit. And one of the words that really inspired me, and maybe Gil can remind me the Pali, at IMC for a while we had this Pali word painted, and I can't for the life of me remember the name, but it means the unconditioned. What's the word, Gil? Amata Dhatu. Thank you. And, you know, and I love that. To me, that kind of demystified the practice for me. It's like, oh, unconditioned. This is actually something that's doable. And to me, it was incredibly inspiring to realize that it's something I know how to do. Sometimes I think of practicing with the hindrances a little bit like Aikido. And this is my idea of what Aikido is. I'm not trained in Aikido, so I may have I may not really know this well enough to say what I'm going to say. But it's a martial art where harmony is central. And the practitioner, you know, you're taught to defend yourself, but they do so while actually protecting the attacker from injury. It's a very different approach. You know, it's a caring for both the you know, yourself and the attacker. Sometimes called the way of unifying energy, which is the tactic of actually blending with your opponent's energy and using their movements, their aggression, to redirect them. And that's a little bit of how it's skillful to work with the hindrances. We don't want to hurt them. We don't want to shove them away. We just want to redirect them in a wholesome way, in a way that we're not opposed to them. I mean, many times, you know, I have so many times over the years paid attention to a hindrance for the purpose of getting rid of it. It was actually one of a really important insight in my own practice. The very first time I looked at a hindrance with the interest and fascination that I would have towards a beautiful sunset. And so it's quite a powerful insight for me. It totally changed my relationship with the defilements of the mind, with the habitual things that I didn't like about myself. It became no longer a problem. It became, oh, look at that. Just like when you're learning a craft, you know, you're learning to saw straight and you realize that, well, okay, if I do that, it's going to be crooked. So you correct it. So in the same way, it can be a very uncharged way of relating to the hindrances. Which sometimes it's hard to do when you think of hindrances like rage and hatred. You know, it's like, you know, to be kind with rage and hatred. So the Pali word vyapada is commonly translated as both ill will and aversion. Both people have different relationships to both words. So see what works for you, what you relate to. It covers the entire range of afflictive attitudes. From the very mild, moderate, to the very, you know, such as being irritated. You know, somebody walks in and they walk in too loud, you know, and so you're just irritated, you know, that unmindful yogi, you know, that those kind of little things that happen, bra straps too tight, little irritation. To the whole range of afflictive emotions we can have, of anger, blame, you know, as I said, rage, resentment, distaste, even impatience is a form of ill will. It's like with impatience, we're I'm going to take a small break and see what... Okay. Okay. I'll just take a side. I was saying... earlier, I was telling one of the yogis here that one of the most inspiring things that I got from Gil back in 1994 when he was giving a talk, and in the middle of the talk, he forgot what he was saying, you know, and he just kind of looked around. He goes, "Oh, this is awkward," you know. And I cringed, and I cringed. I couldn't even begin to relate to being transparent. And so this is awkward being with a mask, you know. So that's how it is. And on camera to all these people online, and my mask is slipping. So okay. So back to ill will. Having only kind feelings towards this mask. You know, we can have ill will towards a person, towards ourselves. Some of the most damaging ill will we have is towards ourselves. Some of the most painful ill will. We can have ill will towards a thought that arose. We can have ill will towards... a physical sensation. And sometimes for things like that, the word aversion might be better to use, right? You know, sometimes with ill will, I think I tend to think of the word as wanting to cause someone harm, you know, ill will. But I don't really want to cause my, you know, the pain in my back harm, you know, so it's more like an aversion. I want to push it away. So for my mind, that word works a little bit better there. So the primary instruction in working with ill will is to get to know it. But before we can get to know any of the afflictive emotions, afflictive hindrances, we need to say it's okay that it's there, to allow it to be there, to you know, to look at it in a friendly manner. If we bring aversion to aversion, we're just making adding more unwholesome energy to it. We're opposing it. We actually make it stronger. So primarily, the first step is to really allow the hindrance to be there. Really, I can't say that too much because that's really an essential piece. It's the only way we get to know someone is to befriend them. It's the only way to actually get to know them, to know all their aspects. And we don't get rid of hindrances. We understand them well enough till they get rid of themselves. They resolve themselves. We don't have to do anything. We just have to know them. And so I tend to think of it as, you know, the hindrance becomes the meditation object. So it's no less worthy than paying attention to the breath, not less worthy than paying attention to the quality of mind. The practice is about being aware, not about having a mind be a certain way. It's about being awake. The image that, one of the images that I use for that as a reminder is we're standing, you know, kind of the top of the mountain, and there's like a beautiful, beautiful landscape we're admiring. And a cloud comes by and clouds the view. You know, do we get mad at the cloud? You know, we can't see clearly anymore. You know, but it's just a cloud, you know, and so we can, it might hang out a while, it might go away soon, but it's just a cloud, you know, and so it's just, in one way, it's just rage. It's just something that arose from conditioning, just like hunger arose from conditioning. So it's just something, something fairly universal. So the second thing that tend to do with the hindrance, you know, we allow it, we accept it, and we want to get to know it, examine it. And the primary way to examine it without getting lost in it is to examine it in the body. When we have ill will in the body, like any form of irritation, anger, anything, there's a contraction, some sort of contraction in the body. And by going to the body, it has two benefits. You know, we get to see and feel the tensions in the body, and which allows us to relax them. But we also, in that moment, we disengage from the story. Ill will is triggered by a thought. Right, even though it's a fleeting thought. We didn't like something. That's a thought. I don't like that. You know, it was unpleasant. I don't want it. It's a thought. Somebody did something to me, you know, and maybe you've had the experience of, you know, something happens, you know. An example I used because it happened to me was that I did a project and at work, and somebody took credit for my project, and I found out, and I was so angry, you know. But by the end of the day, I had kind of let it go. I was feeling fine, and I came home and told my husband about it. And in the retelling of the story, it was just like I just found out about it, just that fresh anger. And really, that's what we do with our minds. You know, we often retell and retell these stories that trigger, I'm not good enough, you know, I'm a bad meditator, I'll never get concentrated, you know, all these things, all these ideas, all these stories, you know, forgetting that they're stories, and this is the body. And the body allows us to really be present and to break that habit. Because that's what it is. It's a habit of going to the story and, you know, triggering the feeling. And this is, you know, depending on our conditioning. Sometimes with some of the really difficult, strong ill will or aversion, some of those, there's sometimes, and Gil talked a little bit about this, that sometimes there's other feelings underneath. Sometimes our anger is fueled by fear. Sometimes it's, you know, fueled by feelings of helplessness. So, you know, we might feel vulnerable. And one of the things about anger is like anger gives us kind of a temporary strength. It makes us feel strong, which definitely feels in some ways better than being helpless. And, you know, we get a rush of adrenaline. And some people actually get addicted to that anger because it's, you know, there's something about it that's actually pleasurable. And that's something that we don't realize, that sometimes what's keeping us hooked on ill will is that it has a little bit of something pleasurable. It's not always the case, but enough of the time, there's something we like about the anger. There's something familiar we might have about the thoughts of self, of putting down ourselves. You know, when we're confronted with a wild animal and we're afraid, having all that anger, all that adrenaline coursing through you is really useful. Not so useful when you're standing in line on a meditation retreat. And the cost, though, of a lifetime of these hindrances, you know, anything associated with ill will, it really takes a toll in our health, and it separates us from people, separates us from others, and definitely has a cost on our peace of mind. Sometimes we don't think of impatience or boredom as aversion or ill will. You know, we often, you know, we're impatient or bored. We go, okay, I'm going to try really hard, focus on my breath, you know, get something to happen, you know. If we turn towards boredom, actually get to know boredom, you know, we can ask the question, what's here that I don't want to feel? Have you paid attention to what it feels like to be bored? There's this very low level unpleasantness, something we just don't like, you know. And by turning our attention to it, it becomes interesting. I mean, we transform boredom into an object of meditation, and it's an interesting. It becomes it's a really powerful entry into these. Just subtle states that we tend to push away. Same thing with impatient, you know. When we're impatient, what are we actually saying? We're saying, this moment isn't worth experiencing. I don't want to be here. spent a lot of time in school not wanting to be here. So got some deep habits there. Another thing that makes anger pleasurable to some of us, not if pleasurable but attractive, is the fact that some people use it as a motivator. You know, they get really angry with themselves for being lazy, for blah 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 blah, and they get really angry with themselves, and then they use that as energy to motivate them. The thing about using that for energy to motivate you is that it's not sustainable. You know, whereas inspiration is an energy that may be a little harder to come by sometimes if we're not in the habit of being inspired, but it's an even strong, sustainable energy that you know, warms our hearts, connects us with life. But when we use this negative energy as a motivator, you know, you know, it's a brittle energy, you know, and doesn't sustain us. One way seeing ill will is that it's often due to one-sided attention. And that's when we give the irritating or repulsive aspects of something or someone a lot more weight than we should, than that's appropriate. And then we can't see the whole picture when we do that. Now, I'll give you an example that happened on a retreat that I was sitting. I was listening to a Dharma talk, you know, it's a really wonderful Dharma talk, and a yogi near me started clicking a pen. You know, they were taking notes, and they just kept clicking. And every time they clicked, you know, just my mind, God, you know, I thought, and to make it worse, it was an experienced student retreat. Okay, that really made it worse. So here it is, an experienced student clicking the pen, you know, and you know, and of course the Dharma talk was on being free, right? Being free of attachment, you know. And of course, you know, it took me a long time to see the irony of that, you know, of how attached I was to that little pen click. And my mind basically saw this person as 95% a pen clicker. Maybe 5% a human being, you know. And it took quite a while for me to really begin to see through that, you know. And, you know, and then I found that this is something that I've done my whole life, you know, where I would see something I didn't like about someone. They'd go, oh, they're a really selfish person. That's who they are. You know, just kind of put them in a nice little box and never take them out of that little box. And we do this to ourselves. You know, I'm not good at this. You know, I'm this way. I'm, you know. Some of us identify with all our faults as opposed to seeing ourselves the whole person. Whatever we think we're lacking, that becomes our 95%. Sometimes with ill will or aversion, it can seem too strong to meet it. It can be confusing or really persistent, you know, and too persistent or too intense to stay with it mindfully. And with any of these afflictive states, we don't have to force ourselves to do it all at once, especially, you know, if fear arises. It's okay to do it in bite-sized pieces. So if something really, really strong arises, we do our best to make it the object of meditation. But if it's too intense, you know, well, maybe not now, you know. So we have to really be wise about this. And so there are other things to do, and we call them remedies or counterbalances. I don't like to rush into a remedy or a counterbalance too quickly. Sometimes people, they have an angry thought, okay, I'm going to do metta. You know, we primarily want to get to know these states. But at other times, something else might be really helpful. for instance, I know some of you have told me, you know, you're being challenged by a lot of physical pain. And one of the ways of working with pain is to really directly look at the sensations of pain and see all the different components of pain and begin to notice the difference between the sensations of pain and or relationship to it. So there's very skillful ways of directly addressing pain, of directly meeting it when it arises and folding it into our mindfulness practice. But there's also times when, especially if the pain's chronic, where it makes the mind grim and we can't, or mindfulness even though we can direct it, it has doesn't have any wholesome qualities. And if we get grim without any wholesome qualities, we're not particularly helping ourselves. And so instead of grinning and bearing it, there's other approaches we can use. And one of the approaches is to bring the attention away from the pain to a different area. For instance, I don't know if you've ever sat on retreat with a really bad headache, but if you have, or sat in meditation with a really bad headache. So if you have, having your attention at the tip of your nose, it's so close to the head, can be really, you know, kind of intensify the headache sometimes. And so bringing the attention down by the belly or in walking meditation, the feet can be really a skillful way to do it. So we're not looking at it directly. We're shifting the attention to somewhere that allows us to stay wholesome, allows our attitude to stay open. Another thing we might do is sometimes when people have really challenging relationships with someone, you know, and every time they think about, you know, maybe divorce, you know, where they have a lot of hostility, a lot of triggers, a lot of baggage, sometimes what's more skillful than trying to look at all those feelings of resentment and all that, all those kind of afflictive feelings, sometimes it's more helpful to take some time and remember the good qualities they have. You know, again, seeing them as a whole person. And it's kind of ironic that, you know, people get divorced. Sometimes, you know, they forget that this is the person they thoroughly loved, you know, who was the most beautiful person in the world at one point. And, you know, and this is one-sided attention. This is what the mind can do. It just focuses on what we don't like, what we don't want. You know, there's a story of this man who went to a classical concert, you know, and the concert was just exquisite, you know. I mean, he said he'd been experiencing this most exquisite concert, you know. And then at the last couple of minutes, a string broke, caused this awful screech. And in his mind, it was a horrible concert. It became a horrible concert because it became 95% of the whole, right? You know, earlier Gil spoke of the Vipassana romance, you know, and as you may have heard, there's the Vipassana vendetta. And I experienced that very strongly in a retreat. You know, we were, it was like a long retreat and, you know, 100 people. And to get to the dining line, there was just one doorway. So there's just one way through to get to the line. And there was a yogi there who was such a good practitioner. He was such a good practitioner who walked so slowly and so agonizingly slowly, not just lifting, moving, stepping, but, you know, doing the six-step version of that. And, you know, he had his cowl, you know, covering his head so he didn't see anybody. And so he was, maybe 99% self-centered, selfish, righteous, for about a week. And, you know, it took quite a bit for me to start turning my attention inward and seeing my own defilements there. And then I finally started seeing him as a whole person. And wow, this guy's really trying to get free. This guy's really trying to be free of suffering, and he's trying really hard. And, you know, it's and he really, you know, needs his practice. He obviously can't see everybody else, you know. So there's a way of holding this, you know. You know, when we get contracted, we stop seeing. We stop seeing, the attention narrows. It just narrows into just those things. And it's the first time I've tried water with a mask. So I want to say just a little more about strength, you know. For the things that we don't like in ourselves, for the things we don't like in others, it takes a commitment, a strength to keep turning towards it and questioning it. And questioning and not falling into our old traps. And one of the things that I... that is important is that energy follows attention. So when we pay attention to something, energy starts flowing in that direction. So maybe to give you an example, if we start reading a book, you know, and we're just kind of just beginning the book, and you know, it's kind of late in the day, and we don't know if it's going to be good. But as we keep giving it attention, and we start getting really into it, you know, I can stay up all night. You know, my energy just comes, and that's the tendency for energy to build when the attention is focused. And that's a little bit of what happens with the mindfulness of breathing or just mindfulness of being in the present moment. The energy follows just by the presence. When we get distracted, we tend to disperse the energy. You know, it gets, and then we kind of keep coming back, and that builds the energy. But if we get distracted, and at that moment, when we get distracted, a few moments later, we turn our attention, we keep our attention steady on the distraction, on the hindrance, then the energy still follows, or interest follows. And we haven't, you know, lost that momentum of awareness, of the habit of being present. So if we're paying attention wholeheartedly, energy flows. And if something unpleasant arises, you know, we can fold that into our experience. It's just part of our experience. And it's really the sustained attention, the habit of sustained attention, that develops our stability and strength in this practice, that allows us to be, you know, kind of like a tree. You know, the storm comes and the, you know, you bend and you flex, but it's just a weather that comes and goes, and the tree is still well rooted. That's kind of how I view strength. It's like this flexibility of the tree, that the branches are moved by the wind, but they're able to flow with it. And one other thing I want to say about energy is that, especially, you know, probably yesterday, I should have said this yesterday. So many people have told me today that they were, yesterday should have been the talk in sloth and torpor, from what I understand. but one way to think of it is, what's the best energy I can bring to the moment? Not have some idea of what good energy is. Like we all know, oh, this is a great sit, right? And, you know, I'm wide awake, I'm alert, my mind's easy to stay here. But sometimes, you know, maybe our body's depleted, maybe we're not feeling well, or there's a lot of different aspects that doesn't yield to a mind that's really fresh. But at those times, in particular at those times, it's really important to bring our best energy, not to force anything. But so how do we bring a gentle energy, a gentle attention that is accepting of the fact that, okay, I'm really tired. You know, it gives us the room to be wise about our tiredness. It gives us the room to be, not to make it wrong, not to struggle with it. You know, oh no, I'm tired. This is ruining my meditation. Oh, sloth. You know, I'm having a bad sit. But how do we bring the right, the really wholesome quality of respect to how we feel? Can we respect everything we feel, everything we experience? Can we have a quality of respect for it? And lastly, you know, and in my own practice, I remember reading the teachings about this, you know, and not really understanding, you know, like I would work with a hindrance, and when it was done, okay, I'm back to the breath. I don't want to do the next step, you know. The next step is of getting to know a hindrance and having it resolved is to appreciate that it's gone. To actually appreciate how you feel when you're free of a hindrance. And that really strengthens our willingness to be without a hindrance. And, you know, it took me a while to really get that was like a really an important part of knowing a hindrance is knowing when a hindrance is gone. Knowing how good we feel when there's no more ill will in my heart. You know, after, you know, feeling really hateful or feeling really irritable, and all of a sudden not feeling that way anymore, that feels good. You know, and so recognizing that. So please take a moment to appreciate that. Because what we're appreciating is what it is to not cling. I mean, we have, you know, that's what this practice is about, to not cling. So we notice these moments of freedom. We notice what it feels like to not be clinging. And what happens is a mind that's conditioned to constantly go, not good enough, that's you're wrong, you're this, you're that, you know, that's continuously doing that, eventually begins to mature into a mind that can really recognize discernment, that can discern. It doesn't mean that we have rose-colored glasses and we don't see that person did something rude. You know, we still see that, but we might see the rudeness as 5% instead of 95%. You know, so discernment is the maturing of this tendency to see what's wrong with everything, to push the things we don't want to push them away. You know, there's a lot of things that should be pushed away in terms of pollution. You know, we don't want pollution. You know, but we don't have to rile against it. We can do what we can do. So it's how we hold it. We still notice all the same things. We might notice them, but we see them in the context of the whole, without giving them undue importance. And so that's, you know, that's basically what I was saying, you know, that we have the tendency to give things one-sided attention, you know. And we tend to think that if things are unpleasant, there's something wrong with the universe, you know, or we did something wrong and something needs to happen. But the more we allow ourselves to be okay with what's unpleasant, the more we can allow ourselves to feel our own suffering, and to really allow it to come and to go, the more it develops our innate compassion, because that's what's there. That's what shows up. When we show up for ourselves fully, that's what shows up, is our compassion. And then we naturally want to comfort, you know, not out of aversion, but out of compassion, out of understanding. So I'd just like to encourage you to keep practicing with the hindrances. I think they'll keep coming up a little bit during the rest of the retreat here and there. And get to know them well. You know, befriend them. you know, and just remember that just by turning our focus mindfully towards the hindrance, it's already transformed. It's already transformed. So thank you. And let's sit together for a couple of minutes.